we sort of glamorize disability, I want to say, in a certain way. We always talk about, you know, people who are blind have amazing hearing and they can still go on to do all these amazing things. And that's totally true. There's nothing wrong with saying that, I suppose. But I had no idea that it impacted development so drastically, and would limit his understanding of the world quite in the way it did.
I'm Sarah Kearns and welcome to the podcast. This is a safe space to discuss the topics affecting everyday families. Let's take an inside look into our own realities and the realities of others. We'll learn together as knowledge creates empathy. Empathy shapes the way that we act, and those actions can change our family and those around us. This is the Conscious Project. This conversation is one I looked forward to for weeks. Claire is an artist and her feed on Instagram is filled with the most incredible artwork. But behind the art is a family who have been faced with more than their fair share of very significant health issues, and a woman who, despite all the difficult moments, bravely rises to the challenge day in and day out. Come meet Claire. Hi, Claire. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to hear your voice.
Oh, I've so looked forward to speaking to you. And I know a lot of people will know you as the artist. And obviously, we will link all of your links and Instagrams and things on the show notes so everyone can come over and check you out. And I know that the second that we learn the family behind a brand or a business on Instagram, we just love their work so much more. And we all just want to get behind the family and support them. And you've just got such a beautiful story and a beautiful family. And yeah, we're so grateful that you're giving us your time today.
Oh, thank you. I'm sitting here nodding along.
Oh, in these times, it's small businesses everything. And I think we've all realized that, you know, the Kmarts and the Targets of the world are going to be fine. It's, you know, and their employees hopefully will be quite safe. But the little businesses, they're the ones that are really taking a hit. So we have to really get behind them.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the other thing is so many small businesses have beautiful stories attached that of, you know, people who didn't necessarily set out to start a small business and live that life, but who have been pushed or guided or led there one way or another. And it does give the business and the product soul and just extra emotional good stuff that maybe isn't always there from a Kmart purchase.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I can so relate to that because obviously we just like fell into doing this and, you know, left my proper career to do it and things like that. And I know that people can look at, particularly on your feed, not so much mine, but all the pretty photos and things and just think, oh yeah, it's so easy for them, or, you know, they've just got this beautiful established business or lifestyle and not understand the risk that went into starting it and the, you know, the struggles, the day-to-day struggles and the issues that we all face. So
exactly.
Yeah. So tell us about, just give us a little intro for people about your family and yeah, how we started your business.
So my name's Claire Devine. I'm the mum of three boys. The eldest has just turned 5 and then the other two are 2 and 3 months old. And I have a beautiful husband, Seamus, who's Irish, as the name would suggest. And we are sort of unexpected small business owners, I suppose, selling my artworks, because we had sort of the horror year, the year before COVID made everyone have a horror year, in that sort of in the space of a year, my husband had a tumour cut out of his knee, and then he had a seizure, and then he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, all at the same time as we had our second baby, who was premature and who was diagnosed with albinism, which means that he's partially blind. So we just had this like bumper year of bad news.
Oh my gosh.
Which resulted in me leaving my teaching career to work from home, you know, not because, or not entirely because I wanted to, you know, be an artist full time, although that's wonderful, but just because you have that much stuff happen in a year and you think, actually, what's important in life? Like, what's important is our family, and spending time together in it and enjoying every second we have. And I think one of the sort of defining moments of my life is when we were told about our son's diagnosis with his vision. We were told that 50% of marriages would break up in the year following the diagnosis. And we just looked at each other and went, like, well, that can't be us. That cannot, what are we going to do so that that's not us? Because if it's 50% of people, then that's, you know, well-intentioned, otherwise happily married people that that would have gone on to stay together maybe, or at least, you know, follow a normal divorce rate trajectory. And so I think, you know, after that moment, that that clarified our position in terms of how we spend our days and how we spend our time. So I suppose that's the very brief story.
Let's unpack that, because I have all the questions. And I think the amazing thing about the podcast, and particularly like our very first episode with Nadine that speaks about Brooklyn and his diagnosis of autism, it's the diagnosis process and the struggles and the everyday moments in your life that perhaps nobody else really has a clue about. And I'm sure people check in on you and go, oh, how are you going? How are things? And you're like, yeah, good, thanks. Yeah. You know, we may have an appointment or we may have this, but nobody really has a clue of what's going on, you know, inside your home except you guys.
Yeah.
And it makes it really hard to support somebody when you hear that they're also going through these really big diagnoses, you know, like there's you've thrown some pretty big words out, you know, that I imagine a lot of people even in your lives are like, holy crap, how do we help? I don't even know what to do to help you.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case. And especially with disability in two parts, I suppose, from my son's perspective, you know, he's a happy-go-lucky toddler. You know, he does look fine, I want to say, because that's what people say to me all the time. They go, oh, but he looks fine. And my husband equally has regained a lot of his memory function, not all of it, since the seizure, which really sort of knocked him around. But I suppose there's that invisible disability conversation there too, where people look fine and therefore, oh, you must be fine. Oh, it doesn't seem so bad. You know, you turned up and smiled on Instagram this morning, so you must be sweet. And so, yes, I definitely think there's meanwhile, there's this big complicated process in the house to do anything, although I think that's true of most families. Just to get everyone out the door in the morning is a major mission, and if you've accomplished that, I think you can give yourself an award.
So what came first, your son's birth or your husband's health issues?
So we probably have a story that you would more than relate to, in that it took us 7 years to fall pregnant in the first place, and our eldest was premature. So then when we had a second premature baby, whilst we were sort of surprised because there didn't seem to be anything wrong during the pregnancy and it all happened very quickly that he was born at 32 weeks, our middleman, you know, it's still a huge journey having to go into hospital every day for 8 weeks, even when you know what to expect to look after your baby. But we felt fortunate that we'd been through that situation before, and we just felt so fortunate to at that stage have two healthy boys, even if they were premature, you know. Some premature babies are very, very sick. Ours were reasonably robust, I would say. But during that time, Shams had this strange – so while I'm going in and out of hospital every day, Shams had this strange tumour cut out of his knee in a really weird place, and they couldn't tell us – they said it was benign, but they couldn't tell us whether it was going to grow back, which it turns out it did. And they put him on methotrexate, which is a chemotherapy drug. And my husband has had epilepsy for a very long time, but it had been controlled by medication. So I'd never witnessed him having a seizure. He worked in a very high-risk job as a machinist offshore. So I'd chop her out to his job for three weeks at a time and then chop her back. So he had all these high-risk licenses. And I suppose where I'm going with all of this is that the knee was already going to be a problem for him for work, and how do you deal with taking injections offshore chemotherapy injections and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we weren't too worried about that initially because after the baby was born, I had maternity leave. And so we thought, well, we'll have the trip of a lifetime. Our niece and nephew are getting married in the UK. So we'll go over there for 6 months and spend time with family. And worry about this whole knee thing later. And so we packed up with our baby.
I love that. We're just going to put that in a box and we'll deal with you later.
Yeah. Well, you know, like ever the optimist.
We've got shit to do. Yeah, we've got shit to do. We have time for you right now. I love that. It's so me. I love that. Good or bad, it's definitely relatable.
Yes, good or bad, rightly or wrongly, yeah. But that's how I thought. So we packed off to the UK for this trip of a lifetime, thinking that we were going to have this lovely sort of maternity leave. And so we're leaving with a baby that's just come out of hospital, a wild two-year-old. We're exhausted. Anyway, we made it there safely in one piece, and we'd been there for less than 24 hours, and it was sort of 4 a.m. And I was feeding the baby, and you know how you're jet lagged and you're sort of having these strange conversations in the middle of the night. And Seamus hadn't had much sleep on the flight, which is a huge problem with epilepsy, but because his epilepsy had been controlled for so long, it never occurred to me that he could have another seizure, to be honest. And so we're there chatting at 4 a.m., sort of congratulating ourselves, like, we've made it, we're here, we didn't kill the children on the plane for screaming, like, you know, it's all great. And he rolled over to yawn and stretched out his arms. And instead of yawning, he started screaming, like this incredible scream, like a murder movie. And at first I started to say to him, like, don't yawn so loud because you'll wake the baby. Like, damn it, I've just got the baby's, like, newborn baby, shush. And then I realized that it was the start of the seizure and that he was sort of stiffening up and struggling to breathe. And so I remember hitting the timer on the phone because I knew it was really important to time the seizure and put the baby down. And I was thinking to myself, well, this is good. He's already lying down on the bed, so he's got no further to fall. Yeah. But we're in this little rundown farmhouse in the middle of nowhere in the UK with family sort of 200 metres down the road. But, you know, you're jet lagged and you don't really know anyone when it's not your country and not your sort of where you feel safe and comfortable. So I'm calling my brother-in-law repeatedly until he picks up and screaming down the phone at him that Seamus is having a seizure because he'd seen my husband have a seizure before but I hadn't. Yeah. And then I've looked again at the phone because Seamus is now sort of going grey, like, and he doesn't seem to be breathing anymore. Or struggling to breathe, but the breath's not coming in. And I see the timer hit 4 minutes, and I thought, this is bad. Like, after 4 minutes, we'd had a friend just die 6 months before, who was 21, from an uncontrolled seizure. And so when we hit the 4 minute mark, I thought, I don't know what this looks like next. You know. Anyway, we were so fortunate that what happened next was 20 minutes of sheer confusion where he did start to breathe again, but then, you know, couldn't remember how to put socks on, didn't know who he was, didn't know really who we were. Thankfully, my brother-in-law turned up and helped him get dressed because I was not in a position to to deal with that sort of thing. But I suppose apart from the shock of the initial seizure and going into hospital and dealing with all that stuff, what we found out is that whilst a lot of Seamus came back, there's short term and working memory issues that haven't come back. And 2 years later, I think we can more or less assume that what we've got now is sort of how it's going to be. And I'm very grateful for how much he has improved in 2 years' time. But initially, you know, he sort of had to relearn a lot of things that as adults we take for granted, like knowing what clothes to put on. And I think that's the thing that no one talks about. Like, I had no idea that a seizure could knock that much out of your ability to function on a daily basis. And for Seamus, the really heartbreaking thing is not that short-term part, but the part where, because he's had a seizure, he's lost all of his high-risk licenses for work. So he can no longer go back to the job he had. never mind the knee and the methotrexate and whether or not that was ever going to be an issue.
So is that what caused it, by being on that medication?
Look, the doctors have said no. And I mean, you could spend your life, you know, thinking about medical conspiracies. I find it unusual that, you know, he'd just upped the dose of that and then this sort of happened. But then, as I understand it, sleep deprivation is such a strong precursor to seizures. So it could have been anything. But, I mean, he was just totally overloaded with stuff going on, I guess, for him all at once.
So how long did he not know who you were and the kids were and things? Like, did he know when he came to who you were and his brother was? And
yeah, so sort of over the course of an hour, he came back to sort of knowing who we were and who he was. But then, you know, I was running around trying to get passports and stuff to prove who we were at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying to him, "Can you get dressed?" And he's just got no idea sort of how to do that. And then I suppose, you know, in the weeks that followed, it was things like, I know most of us don't remember that, you know, what we had for breakfast, but Seamus very genuinely couldn't remember if he had breakfast. He couldn't remember going up the stairs or going downstairs for any reason, not just beyond, I would say, the usual sort of we walk into a room and go, "Damn, why was I here? What was I coming to get?" Like, it was like a really bad case of that, I would say, or a permanent case of that. He wasn't allowed to drive. He was scared to hold the new baby because he was scared of having another seizure and dropping him. Which is just so heartbreaking.
It's awful for a new dad.
Yeah, I mean, it affects your whole life when you have to have the same conversation sort of six times in a row because he very genuinely didn't remember having it. It was that sort of thing for a lot of months. And then, of course, that was exacerbated by how angry and upset he was that now he wasn't going to be able to work and provide for his family. You know, men do have that provider thing, or certainly all the men I've ever met have that provider instinct. And so to be robbed of that, I think, was exceptionally brutal, especially with a new baby right there, you know?
Yeah, I know that, like, I know Brad's identity is very much linked to his work and you know, not just their success, but their stability and their ability to provide for their families. I know that's a very common thing for men. So that must have been, really. And not only how frustrating that must be when you're telling him the same thing over and over and you would be, I'm sure, you've got a two-year-old and a newborn baby, you'd be getting frustrated. Like, "I've just get the bottle or just get this," and he's, you know, you're having to do it over and over. That would be, I can't imagine how much pressure that is on with a new baby and you know, a baby that's already come into the world under a little bit of trauma and, you know, and medical issues.
Yeah, it was a really intense time.
Oh, so did you stay in the UK or did you come home or what did you do?
Well, we did in the end. I ran out and bought a really old car to drive around in because I only have an automatic license and everyone in Seamus's family has a manual license, and we'd just assumed that he would be doing all the driving while we were there. But we thought, well, we're here and, you know, how, as a teacher, how often would I have that leave? And it was nice for Seamus to be surrounded by his own family while we were grappling with all of...
Kind of a blessing that it happened there with family to support.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot.
It was a really, really big time. And so moving forward, even this time last year, I suppose there were some really big moments of confusion. Like, I feel like Seamus is, you know, the routine stuff that happens all the time. Like, he would never forget to feed our children or never, but appointments, we have to set alarms and write things down. And then the problem with that is that he doesn't think to check what's written down or there's sort of backups on backups on backups, which is fine. But also there's the struggle, I think, that continues, that is being in a sort of house husband dad role for him, which he does incredibly well, and he's the most wonderful, beautiful father and husband, but that's not the life that he would choose. Do you know what I mean? He was off doing this scary, high-risk role where...
Adrenaline, yeah.
Yeah, and so to go from that to domesticity, I think, is a shock for anyone when it's not you making that decision.
Yeah, it's the not having the choice. Having that choice taken away from you must be very, very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, that's it. And the frustration for him of his insurance not covering it. You know, not that we were looking for a payout, but you assume that you have this life insurance and that this workers cover to cover you if you cannot work because you have obligations, you know. Yeah. And so when that doesn't come through, it's sort of like, oh, we're really on our own here. We've got to find a solution.
Yeah, gosh. So once you get back, I guess you're kind of forced into the role of having to be the provider as well. So not only is he forced into the role that he's now going to stay home, you're forced into the role of, okay, well, you're now carrying the basket, which Brett and I would say, when you're carrying the basket with all of our eggs in it. Don't drop the basket.
Yeah, that's
you've been given the basket.
That's it. That's such a powerful metaphor. So we came back, and I went back to teaching for one term, which, you know, was totally heartbreaking because I was still breastfeeding and I had to wean the baby because I couldn't possibly, not that my work wouldn't have been supportive of me, you know, expressing and doing all of that at school, but I didn't have the mental space for all of that. So we'd been away for 6 months. We come back. We had this doctor's appointment that we sort of knew that we had something to do with Shiloh's eyes and vision. And he had nystagmus, which is where your eyes involuntarily move from side to side as they try to focus. But I'd sort of thought, well, that's kind of a, like, maybe that's a preemie baby thing. Like, my eldest didn't have that, but surely, you know, it's not actually a big deal and it'll just right itself. I'd had enough to deal with Shamus's stuff.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like, they'd said to me, oh, there could be an issue with your baby's sight some months before, but that just, I mean, I feel like a terrible mother saying this, but I forgot. Like, that seemed so beyond the realms of possibility.
I think that's probably pretty reasonable, being faced with what you were being faced with. Like, there's only so much our minds can even cope with at one time.
That's it. But I thought, you know, I'm breastfeeding this baby. I'm cuddling him all the time. He's giving me social smiles. They can't possibly, like, I know my baby. There can't possibly be something wrong with his vision. But we came back and went back to work, and then we've had this meeting, and we've had his eyes tested, and they've said, well, hang on, he's not seeing, or he's only seeing very close up. You know, so that's why he's smiling at you, because you're holding him very close to your face, but he's missing all his milestones. And, you know, again, I hadn't been worried about that because premature baby. So what is the timeline for milestones? Like, is it really important? Those were the sorts of, you know, I was so relaxed about that.
Yeah.
So I suppose I missed all the signs. One, because I was distracted with Shamus and the sort of shake up of our lives, but two, because of the prematurity thing, it just wasn't on my radar to check. And so we were totally shocked when the diagnosis of albinism came in, because it came in at the same week as Shamus was confirmed as having prostate cancer, which, thank goodness, hasn't progressed so far and is nicely under control. But it was another one of those big weeks where you just get slammed with everything. And it turns out albinism, so is a genetic condition, and it's very rare, and we just happened to be able to pass it on to our baby, which the geneticist explained to me is because part of my family is going way back, is from the same part of Northern Ireland that Shamus is from. And so way, 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 way long ago, we are sort of related, and that's how we've both got this gene that allowed us to have this baby, which is quite incredible. And it's a 1 in 4 chance for us of having a baby with albinism, but we had no idea. And we had no idea that albinism, like, I just thought that was like those vampire kids with red eyes and white skin and white hair. I had no idea that it could actually, you know, very seriously limit their sight and impact their vision. And I had no idea that that losing one of your senses, like we sort of glamorize disability, I want to say, in a certain way. We always talk about, you know, people who are blind have amazing hearing and they can still go on to do all these amazing things. And that's totally true. There's nothing wrong with saying that, I suppose. But I had no idea that it impacted development so drastically, and would limit his understanding of the world quite in the way it did. So that was a huge learning curve. And I find that particularly shocking, I think, because I've worked with so many exceptional learners. I really love working with children with varying needs as a high school teacher. I've got 4 degrees. I consider myself to be reasonably intelligent. And yet when it came to my own child, I just had no idea that all of this stuff could be, you know, could so deeply impact his little life and his experience of the world, you know.
So how old was he when this diagnosis came through?
8 months.
8 months, yeah, okay. Wow. So I just can't imagine with the pressures that you being under, like it must be literally like at the end of the day, you're running through, okay, this doctor said this about that and then this is the plan with this and like your poor mind must have just been, and you've still got another child here you're supposed to be caring for.
Yeah, it's intense. I remember at the time though, I'd just gone back to work, so I was trying to do a good job, and I left to go to the appointment where they were going to tell us Shiloh's diagnosis. And I remember saying to my boss, "Oh well, I'll see you tomorrow." And he said, "No, you won't. Surely you're taking tomorrow off." And I've gone, "Well, no, because I've got to teach and I've got classes and I've got and his the look on his face, and I thought, "Oh, maybe I am taking tomorrow off. What? How bad can it be?"
Yeah, you just had your hat on and you're like, "I'm just going to get everything done. I'm just in that mode of getting everything done for everybody."
Yeah, and I think we do this when we're under pressure and we've got a lot on. We just power through, and then cop the huge emotional fallout after the fact or later, or set that aside, because you do have to be strong for your family or support your family to the best of your ability.
8 months old is pretty young. So do you start doing, is there therapies and things that you can do for Shiloh to help him?
Yeah, absolutely. So we registered with the NDIS, which I would say is a full-time job in itself.
Yeah,
and I suppose that's what I want people to hear is that the NDIS is a minefield for – it's wonderful and I'm really grateful for it, but it is so, so difficult for anyone to deal with it as a system. Shiloh's eligible for a lot of therapy, which we're very grateful for, because whilst he's happy and he runs around, our biggest fear was that he would be scared to move in space, like scared to move forward in case he hit himself, whereas he just runs, and if he smacks into something, you know, he falls down and gets up again. He keeps going. He's forever a little bit bruised.
Typical 2-year-old.
Yeah, that's it. So there is a lot of beautiful, typical behaviour there, but equally because he's sort of missed out on a lot of these milestones in his first year in particular, we've got to rebuild or sort of open up his brain, I suppose, through a mixture of physical therapies and speech therapies to just fill in the gaps that he would have just naturally missed from not seeing things to reach out for things. Well, you know, most babies reach out to touch toys. Well, if you can't see that there's a toy there, then you don't bother reaching out for anything because there's nothing to see. There's nothing there according to your experience. So we're so, so grateful for NDIS, because otherwise we would never be able to afford the level of intervention that he needs. And our goal is for him to attend a normal school. But that does mean that we need to put everything aside and just focus on him for now. And so that means 3 days of therapy a week playing with him and doing all the follow-up exercises that really cement those learnings for him. Even little things like rolling over. Like we didn't realise that he sort of couldn't roll over properly, whatever that means, but apparently there's a way that babies roll over that's really important for their development. And he wasn't doing that. He just sort of skipped rolling over.
Okay.
So very, very interesting. But the NDIS, whilst it's totally wonderful, it is a full-time job on itself, managing that experience and the payments and finding the right providers. And a lot of providers don't want to work with you if your baby is quite young, or they only want to work with you if you sign up for 6 months of agreement with them, or they want to sort of know how much funding you have so that they can sort of use your funding, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And so it took us a long time to get the right providers that we felt really safe working with and who we felt really confident with working with our little boy. And I think that that's what makes the NDIS so challenging is it's all well and good to think, oh, well, this is just a business transaction. I need to find a speech therapist, so I'll just call speech therapists. But you can't just do that because you've got this huge emotional involvement where it's your child who you know best and you want the best for them. So not just any speech therapist will do, I'm sorry. It's got to be the right fit for your family and something that you feel comfortable, you know, taking him to and someone you feel comfortable him learning with and learning from. And, I mean, even all the meetings and everything to be registered with the NDIS, I feel really fortunate that I came from a teaching background and that I had all of the language and I understood childhood development and milestones, and I could really succinctly explain what was going on for Shiloh in his daily life and how that differed from perhaps a traditional norm. But I can't imagine how you navigate the system without, like, I felt lost and confused, and I already had, I'd studied this stuff. So I can't imagine how parents working other roles who haven't studied child behaviour development, all that stuff, then come into dealing with this on top of working and doing everything else that needs doing, like laundry and feeding children every night.
Yeah, with children with needs that, you know, are different from, you know, three therapies a week and then all the homework and things that go along with that. That's a full-time job in itself, never mind doing everything else plus adding, you know, this kind of NDIS paperwork and things on top. That's a lot for one or two people.
Yeah.
And your backup was needing his own support. So
yes, exactly that. So Seamus is wonderful in terms of taking Shiloh to therapies and doing the legwork, I suppose, now that he's allowed to drive again.
Oh, great. But, so he can drive.
But still the focus of organising everything and coordinating everything still comes back to me, which is fine, I suppose, because, you know, teaching background, so coordinating stuff is sort of...
You've got that shit covered.
It doesn't mean it's not exhausting, but I'm grateful to have a skill set.
Oh, we should just let the teachers run the world, I think.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people feel like that after the lockdowns, unfortunately. Oh, mate,
get some teachers in that Parliament House, I reckon. They will have it all sorted in a week. So obviously you've got a two-year-old. I'm just thinking of like Teddy's two.
Yeah.
It'll be three in October. So they're, you know, the same age. And that child, it gives me a heart attack on a daily basis.
Yes.
And he's very similar to, like you said, Michelle, just runs, and if he smacks into something, he smacks into something. But, I mean, Teddy has his vision, so he can see if there's something, you know, he often, you know, they're two. They're going to hurt themselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, Shiloh's already at such a disadvantage. So you must be actually really scared sometimes that he could really injure himself, that, you know, do you have stairs in your house or things like that? Like, how far can he see? Does he wear glasses? Like, what does his everyday look like?
I'm
trying to get to.
So Shiloh will have glasses when he's older, we think.
Right.
For now, we feel quite confident because he can't tell us yet, so we have to wait till he can tell us, but we feel confident that he can see up to 80 centimetres in front of him, depending on the light. So dim light seems to change his vision and his perception. Where Shiloh really stands out, I suppose, is that he has every room in our house mapped out. So I don't know how his little brain works, but it's quite amazing that both at kindy and at home he knows exactly where everything is so that he avoids running into most of it. But to test that theory, if we move a piece of furniture by a couple of centimetres, that's a crash straight away. He's going to run into it. Or a box of toys, if a box of toys is left out, even if he's seen the box, played with toys in the box, he'll then turn around and fall over it because it's not where it's mapped and memorised for him.
So he's really got it in his head. That's incredible, isn't it?
So I think quite often he appears to see better than he does by virtue of this, you know, incredible mapping that he's got. But, yes, stairs, he had his first tumble down the stairs the other day. We finally took the gate off because he was climbing over the gate anyway. So we thought, well, this is not...
2-year-old.
This is not helping anyone's stress levels, let alone mine. But he did take his first tumble down the stairs. And that's, you know, part of that's normal childhood stuff, and part of it is extra heartbreaking because you think, gosh, like... Being two is already tough, you know, big emotions, not able to fully express or deal with them yet, lots of rules, and restrictions, lack of freedom, and then but I mean the grace of it, I suppose, is that he knows no different, and it's not a degenerative condition. So the vision that he has now is the vision that he will have. And so I'm grateful for that too. Like, it sounds counterintuitive, but I feel like so much more could have gone wrong, and that the vision that he has is good, usable vision. We think that he'll be able to read stuff if it's really up close to his face, like if he sticks his nose into the book. Mm-hmm. And I feel like kids are doing that with their iPads and iPhones and stuff anyway now, like they're holding phones right up to their face. Yep. Sorry, I'm doing it here and no one can see me, but I'm miming it for you. So I feel like, you know, there's an upside there in an awful, terrible way that you'd never wish on anyone, you know?
So he doesn't like watch TV or anything like that?
So he watches The Wiggles quite intensely, but he has to be right up next to the TV screen.
Yeah.
There's
probably all the beautiful colours moving around.
Yeah, that's it. And I think he has a crush on Emma Wiggle.
Yeah, who doesn't? Come on. Every little kid.
That's exactly it. But so he can't sit on the couch and watch.
Yeah.
And watch TV. Sure. No. And different games, like obviously his brother wants to throw a ball with him. Well, that's just a ball to the face.
Oh, Baba. That must be so hard. So his brother, how old's his brother now? Five.
Five, just turned five.
Yeah. So that's a really big age too. Like obviously my boy is now a 7, 5 and 2. So I'm 2 years ahead of you. And I often say that, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 and then 4.5 to 5.5 are big. It's really big. So I can imagine that is, you know, you're obviously dealing with normal 5-year-old kid struggles too, which is, a whole ball of fun at times. But how is he with his brother and understanding that comprehension that, hey, maybe don't just throw something at his face.
Yeah.
Because you could hurt him.
he's as good as any 5-year-old could be, I think.
Yeah.
Sasha, his superpower is being overly empathetic for a 5-year-old, and I'm so grateful for that. He loves being a big brother. He was so delighted to have both of his little brothers. He was never once sort of jealous or upset at losing being the only child. Like, he's just loved being a big brother.
Was he stoked that they were boys?
Yes. Or, oh, no, the last one, he would have liked a sister. He did correct me when I told him it was a boy. He did say, no, mummy, sister. Like,
We don't make girls. You like us.
Yeah.
We don't make girls.
That's it. But, you know, three boys, I mean, not that we're having any more children, unfortunately, but if we were to have more now, I'd love another boy. Like, once you're on the boy train, it's great fun.
I know. It's so fun, isn't it? And wait till you've only got a newborn, but obviously Teddy's, the third is now two, but oh my gosh, they're hard work.
Yeah.
I remember thinking that Finn and Knox were hard work, and now Teddy's two. He had a meltdown at 6 a.m. this morning for 45 minutes because he wanted to be Spider-Man, but he could only find Knox's Spider-Man outfit because he knows at two what is that's the bigger size and it will be too big for him. And I'm like, how do you even know this? You're two. Like, I didn't have to argue with your brothers at two about being Spider-Man and being the wrong Spider-Man.
Oh, but he just wanted to be Spider-Man, Mum. Oh, isn't it beautiful, but also so full on.
Such big emotions. Yeah, such big emotions. So you're dealing with all of this and a newborn.
Yeah, it's a little bit intense. But no, Sasha is a beautiful big brother. He we had a beautiful moment in the car the other day where because he's aware that Shiloh is different, but I was never sure sort of how much of that had filtered through to him. But he said to me in the car the other day, you know, is Clancy, our third baby, is Clancy going to be like Shiloh? And I said, what do you mean, darling? Do you mean in terms of what he can see? And Sasha said to me, yes, is he going to be like Shiloh and can't see, or is he going to be like me and he can see? And I said, well, we still have to have some tests done just to be sure, but we think he's going to be like you. We think he can see. We think that's all okay. And it was like the relief that came over this 5-year-old's face in the rearview mirror. And I had no idea that would be something that he would think about, worry about, or that would even occur to him, you know?
That was really quite amazing. Precious.
I'm so glad Shiloh has two brothers. You know, I know when I look back, like look at my kids, I think I'm so glad you have each other, and when we're all old and you'll have each other, and I just hope that they keep that bond, because you just think, you know, as a parent, they'll be okay if they just have each other.
Yeah, I so hear that. Like my heart hears.
Yeah, I bet it does. I bet it does. Oh, so let's move into you then. You've got this massive diagnosis for Shiloh. You're still working. I imagine you took the next day off and then got back into it like our amazing teachers do. They just keep on moving. And then how did we get to running your business and leaving teaching?
Oh, and so heartbreaking. Like, I truly feel like teaching was my vocation, like what I felt called and compelled to do. I knew from when I was 10 I was going to be a teacher. And, you know, I'm so grateful for what I do now and that I can be home with my family, but that doesn't negate the heartbreak of leaving that role. And I imagine that you had really mixed feelings when you took that step. Oh, I mean, family comes first, but you still have part of you that goes, oh, I had this other life. I had this other trajectory.
Yes. I'll always be a cop in my heart.
Yeah.
You say you'll always be a teacher.
Yeah. It's so much. I mean, so much of our identity is tied to our work. I mean, it's a fascinating experiment in that. I always think our family is just experimenting with identity.
Yeah, well, you and Seamus have both had the same, I want to say, like forced decisions with your careers and things of having to put your family first. Like that's huge. It's a big sacrifice on both of your parts.
Well, I mean, you know, yes and no, because family does come first. But I suppose with any transition, there's major emotions. So I did stay in teaching for a term, but I just went to my boss and I told him everything that had been going on, which he basically already knew. And I said, could I have some unpaid leave, because I just don't know. I can't keep turning up to teach other people's children when I know that I've got boys at home that really need me. And he said to me, but what are you going to do for money? And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I don't know either, mate.
That's a great question.
Yeah, great question. Because he knew that Seamus wasn't able to work. And I ended up taking the leave. And I'd had this sort of art business on the side, just for a bit of something to take up my evenings, I suppose, while Seamus was away working fly in, fly out, when I only had one baby and life wasn't quite so complicated. but it wasn't, the new divine wasn't ready to pay all of our bills. It was just a nice little extra bit of income, I suppose. But where we were really fortunate is that when I was taking leave was also when Australia was locking down, which is not the part that was fortunate. Sorry, this is a strange sort of dichotomy of timing. But because everyone was suddenly at home and the call was put out to support small businesses, the support came in for us. And I think part of that was that I did, having left my job, you know, even on leave, I felt like I could actually say online what had been going on for us, which I'd kept relatively under wraps, because as teachers you're always very careful about what you share. And so I was finally able to say, actually, we've just had the year from crazy. Like, I don't even know where to start with what we've been through, but what we want to do is stay home and look after each other. The support just went bananas and the business just basically exploded overnight. So I left work on the Friday, and on the Sunday the business was generating enough to pay the bills to keep us going.
Wow. God, incredible. I love living in Australia. Isn't it incredible? Like, how many times have we heard this where a plea is put out and the community just goes, yep, we got you. Like, our family's got your family.
Yeah, I think that's the real the beauty of the Australian spirit, is that community sense. And I think that's what got a lot of people through last year.
Yeah, I agree.
And yeah, we were just so fortunate to be caught like that and caught and
you're
carried.
Very talented. Let's not take that away from you. They didn't just, you know, you're very talented, and it's, you know, it's a lot of hard work, and it's all you. But it's lovely to hear that people went, yeah, we're gonna help you, and we've got you back.
Yeah. Yeah, just incredible. So running a small business from home with the whole family and everything else thrown in ever since. I only just resigned last Friday, actually. I've been
officially
on unpaid leave and maternity leave, and that's a very teary little interview, but or little meeting, I should say. But the reality is that now, looking forward with what we know now about Seamus's health, which is far more stable than it was, but equally doesn't allow him to return to a traditional job, and what we know in terms of the ongoing stuff for Shiloh, like, we just can't buy these years back. And I'm sure all mothers feel like that. The years under five, whether you choose to go back to work or you have to go back to work because life is expensive.
Yeah.
We all have this sense that that first 5 years is so vital and so impossible to replicate later. And so really, I mean, it was an obvious decision in so many ways that we just know that we need this time for all of our boys, but especially for Shiloh, to support him so that he can go to a normal school, we hope. Nothing else matters more than that, you know. I mean, we're so fortunate to be in a position where we can make that happen, just so long as I never sleep ever while I'm running his stuff and running the business.
That's all right. There's so many people that follow me and listen that are small business owners, so I know that they feel you with every part of their body. Like, it's just that. And I think, and, you know, even us, Brad's just left his job and
so
very well-paying salary, you know, that he worked his absolute butt off for a very long time, you know, left the army, left the police and started from scratch, built his way up.
Amazing.
And then has walked away from a salary in the middle of a pandemic.
Yes.
So, you know, cool. We're fine.
Yeah.
But it's nerve-wracking and it's so much work. Like, I look at him and I literally booked him into the Cairo this afternoon and I'm like, you know what, we're paying all this money for health insurance and he doesn't want to spend money on anything at the moment because obviously he's not making any, but I'm like, you are going because you are sitting in front of that computer. Just, you know, he comes out, feeds the kids dinner and goes back in until I drag him off at midnight. And I know so many business owners do that. And it's so much more work than just a traditional 9 to 5. So
Exactly. And because the times aren't set, you end up, and because it's your own, your baby, really, the business becomes like a baby. And so you spend all these extra hours. I so relate to that. When I was still teaching, when I thought about running a small business and being an artist full time, I thought, oh yeah, wouldn't that be great? Just wake up in the morning, get the kids off to school, have a coffee, put on my activewear and go to yoga.
We've all been there. I feel like every single small business owner right now is like, yes, this was not what was in the brochure.
Yeah.
This is not what I signed up for.
Exactly that. I'm like, where's the twice weekly like lunches for sushi train with my friends and like the naps, all the naps I was going to take.
Oh, I know. But like you said, you get all this time with your kids and what a gift. And, you know, they're going to look back and not only, like you said, your eldest has just got this beautiful sense of empathy and compassion. And I'm such a humongous believer that our boys, particularly, we need to just flood with empathy and compassion because that's what's going to make them into the men that can change, you know, change the script of what we're seeing a lot with men in this day and age. And empathy is, it's just where it starts, at where it ends. It's, and he's watching everything that his mum and dad are doing and for himself and his brother. And that's the best lesson, isn't it? Like,
it's
beautiful.
I really think it is. It's so, so precious. And we do want boys that are kind and generous and thoughtful and critical of the world around them. I mean, I'm sure that they get a lot of that at kindergarten and at school too, but to be in a position where we can share so much of that with our children, it is a huge privilege and a huge responsibility. I think raising boys in this time, and I know you know exactly what I mean, I feel is a huge responsibility that we have to help change this script and to,
change the world.
Change the world.
Make it better. Make it better. Let's get, you know, these beautiful boys we have that are wearing all colours of the rainbow and they're crying when they get hurt and they're talking about things and, like, this is what we want. This is what we want our men to be doing when they're our ages. So it's such a, this is how it starts. I know a lot of people sort of say, when they're older, well, how do, what do we do now? And it's like, oh, it's such a harder path when you're trying to help a 30-year-old unlearn things that they've learned and, you know, lots of therapy and lots of work on themselves. So if we can start them as babies.
Yes.
It's going to be amazing what they're going to grow up to be.
Yeah, completely different conversation. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, you guys are amazing. We're just get behind Claire and her family. We'll link all of your stuff on our show notes so that you can find her and follow along. And you are a truly talented artist, and obviously your skills and your talent has, I'm just so glad that people are being able to see it. And isn't social media so powerful that it can link to all of these people and they can see your work and have a little bit of your family in their homes?
Yeah, and it's so reassuring to share experiences. Like, that's what I love about socials is I've met so many other parents with albinism, so many other small business owners who have had a similar journey to us, where health has made them take a different path, or where, you know, they have decided that, you know, spending time with a family is more important than immense financial success or immense sort of importance in another role and in another position in another company. There's something really beautifully human about sharing those stories, and comforting each other that it's not just us going through this stuff. And as you say, there are so many things going on in other people's homes that we're not necessarily aware of, or we think, oh, maybe that's not such a big deal. And actually it's had been this catalyst for major life change. I suppose I want to reassure people that that's a really common story. You know, ours isn't a story out there in isolation, and no one wants a pity party, but, you know, life's tough for a lot of people, and that's okay in the sense that so many of us are going through it. You know, it's not just any of us on our own. You say it all the time about people being up in the night, mothers being up in the night with their babies. Yeah. You know, you are not alone.
No. I read something the other day that was doing the rounds on social media, and it was like, you know, it's not about how much stuff somebody has on their plate, because, you know, they may be holding a paper plate and not a ceramic plate, or their plate might be a lot smaller than somebody else's plate, so it's not able to carry as much. And there's just so many different circumstances. And I know a lot of us on social media fall into looking at someone's grief and going, oh my God, how easy is their life, and how wonderful is this? And there's so much that goes on behind closed doors. So it's, having that empathy for people and doing what you can to support each other is just, it's so powerful. And, you know, I think we obviously cop a lot of negativity online and things like that. And this week's actually been a really, really hard week for me personally online. But I just think that, you know, for as long as we're having these conversations and we're spreading this awareness and spreading, you know, the need for empathy and kindness for other people, then it's absolutely worth it. And we can all grow and help each other. It's never the wrong way. It's never going to be the wrong thing to do.
No, that's right. And we've never needed community more than we do now. And I think that you do an incredible job of that, and an incredible job of normalizing and just showcasing life for what it is, you know, the normality of not every day is glossy and perfect. And I think that's a beautiful thing to be reminded of now more than ever.
Oh, definitely. It's the finding the joy in the chaos and the joy in the everyday, because at the moment we are locked down and we have got to find joy in the small moments. But, you know, as much as we all hate what's happening right now and how hard it is, I think perspective is everything. And if we can find something every day just to go, there's a positive here. It may not be the positive I wanted. It may not have been a positive if life was normal, but today it's a positive and I'm going to jump on it and I'm going to appreciate it. And, you know, when we look back at this time when our kids are grown up and we say, oh my God, remember those crazy years? And hopefully the kids will say, I remember you dancing with us in the lounge room, and I remember you and Dad turning the news off and you looked really stressed, so we all went for a walk instead. And, you know, trying to move through it, because we're forming their little characters, and they're going to be such incredible people, I think, living through all of this.
Yes, I think so. Truly a remarkable story for them to tell their grandchildren.
Absolutely.
Oh,
thank you so much for your time. I'm blown away. I just think you guys are just such a beautiful family, and your boys' names are just so bloody adorable.
That's Seamus.
Clancy is just the cutest thing I've ever heard.
Well, Seamus pieces the names, so that was every birth was a surprise for the name for me. But yes, Clancy.
So cute.
it's a winner.
Oh, God, it's so cute. So cute. Oh, enjoy the rest of your day and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you too, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in today. I would love to continue the conversation with you over on Instagram at The Conscious Project Podcast. Hit subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. And I would be so grateful if you would take a moment to leave me a 5-star review. It really does help. Take care.